Welcome to the September 2015 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan or This Month in other journals besides the AJNR. As usual, I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 8 articles from the recent literature that I've found of interest, and I hope you will find them of interest as well. The references that I am discussing will all be posted onto the AJNR blog for your convenience. The first paper has a first author of Deng, and the title is Comparison of Language Cortex Reorganization Patterns Between Cerebral Arteriovenous Malformations and Gliomas, a Functional MRI Study. And this is from Journal of Neurosurgery from 2015. The authors retrospectively reviewed the clinical and imaging data of 63 patients with left-sided unruptured cerebral AVMs and 38 patients with a left-sided glioma who underwent fMRI. The patients were further categorized by lesion location into either a Broca area subgroup or a Wernicke area subgroup. Lateralization bold signal indices were calculated separately for the Broca and Wernicke areas. Of the 34 patients in the AVM Broca's area subgroup, right-sided lateralization of the Broca area was detected in 9 patients, about 26%, and right-sided lateralization of the Wernicke area was detected in about 11 to 12%. Of the 29 patients in the AVM Wernicke subgroup, about 7% had right-sided lateralization of Broca area, and 45% had right-sided lateralization of the Wernicke area. In the glioma group, 16% showed right-sided lateralization of Wernicke, and no patient showed right-sided lateralization of Broca's area. They conclude, given all those numbers, that the potential for reorganization is much greater in the AVM group, and that isolated reorganization of solely Broca or solely Wernicke areas will occur when AVM nidus is located specifically near those areas. The single task performed in this study by all the patients was a silent reading task. The authors note that the activations of both the Broca and Wernicke areas were observed in all the patients, but multiple tasks may improve the accuracy and reliability of these type of conclusions. Second paper, a first author of Ganco, and it's entitled, Can Bacterial Infection by Low Virulent Organisms Be a Plausible Cause for Symptomatic Disc Degeneration? A Systematic Review. This is from Spine in 2015. The authors performed a search of 6 electronic databases for studies investigating the potential relationship between disc infection as a cause for degenerative disc disease and symptomatic neck and back pain or radiculopathy. 9 relevant studies involving 602 patients with degenerative disc disease or pain were identified. Overall pooled infection prevalence in all studies was 36%. The majority of infections were due to Propionibacterium acne. While the direct link between infection and back pain cannot be excluded, they conclude that there is still a lack of robust clinical evidence to conclusively demonstrate a link between disc infection as a causal mechanism of disc degeneration and radiculopathy. The authors note several limitations of the studies included in the systematic review, including that the studies were predominantly observational, they were non-randomized in design and subject to selection bias, and that the methodology of infection detection varied between the studies. So in other words, it remains interesting to think about, but we still don't know one way or the other if the low-grade infection underlying disc degeneration or back pain hypothesis has merit. We are going to have to wait for better studies. Third paper is by Goldschlager, and it's entitled Giant Cell Tumors of the Spine. Has denosumab challenged the treatment paradigm? And this is from Journal of Neurosurgery Spine from 2015. Giant cell tumors histologically show nodules of osteoclast-like giant cells from which the tumors arise. Osteoclasts express the receptor activator of nuclear factor kappa B ligand, which we all know as RANKL, which is an essential mediator for osteoclast survival. Denosumab is a monoclonal antibody against RANKL and showed tumor response in 86% of patients in a phase 2 study. That paper has a first author of Thomas. It's from Lancet Oncology, volume 11, page 275, and from 2010. This study by Goldschlager was a prospective consecutive series of 5 patients with primary spinal giant cell tumors that were treated with denosumab from 4 centers. The response to denosumab varied from 10% reduction of tumor size in 3 patients, 40% reduction in 1 patient, and a greater than 90% reduction in the 5th patient, and that patient did not receive surgery. Final histological investigation revealed complete obliteration of all tumor cells and replacement with sclerotic fibrooseous tissue with interstitial hemosiderin. The mean follow-up was 12 months. The authors note that following denosumab treatment, there was a remodeling of the vertebrae, but the extracompartmental tumor tended to shrink only slightly and to calcify. Also, the epidural tumor had greater regression following denosumab treatment. They conclude that denosumab has the potential to change the treatment paradigm for spinal giant cell tumors. This article has 5 figures, including 3 PET CT figures. Obviously tough to get large patient numbers with this tumor, but the results seem very impressive. The 4th paper has a first author of Murphy, and it's entitled MR Epidurography, Distribution of Injectate at Caudal Epidural Injection. This is from Skeletal Radiology in 2015. This is an interesting study evaluating the distribution of gadolinium contrast within the epidural space following epidural injection via the sacral hiatus. 20 patients who were referred with symptomatic low back pain were treated with either 10 cc's or 20 cc's of injectate administered. The 10 cc group, there were 9 and 11 patients in the 20 cc group. Gadolinium was included in the injection. The patients proceeded to MR, where sagittal and coronal T1-weighted fat-saturated sequences were acquired. Specifics regarding the injectate were 80 to 160 milligrams of methylprednisolone acetate and 4 to 8 cc's of 0.25% bupivacaine. That was made up to a total volume of either 10 or 20 cc's with sterile saline. MagnaVist was included in all cases at a standard 1 to 200 concentration, which is a tenth of a cc in 20 mils of solution. Gadolinium was observed at or above the L3-4 disc level in all 11 patients who received the 20 cc's of injectate, compared with only 5 of 9 patients who received 10 cc's. In 5 patients, the higher volume showed contrast up to the T12L1 level. Despite showing that a larger volume of injectate gets medication to a higher level in the spine, as would be expected, it is unknown whether patients fare better clinically with this higher volume. The images are worth looking at. I think they're impressive, which in one case shows epidural contrast near the cervicothoracic junction from this sacral hiatus injection. There are 4 MR figures in the paper. Number 5 has the first author of Scott, and this is entitled Clinical and Radiologic Outcomes Following Traumatic Grade 1 and 2 Carotid Artery Injuries, a 10-year retrospective analysis from a Level 1 trauma center. This is from Journal of Neurosurgery in 2015. The authors describe a retrospective review of 117 grade 1 to 2 blunt carotid injuries in 100 patients. Final imaging at 60 days showed that 64% of the cases had resolved, 13% were stable, and 9% improved, whereas 14% radiographically worsened. 54% of the cases were treated with aspirin, 30% thereabouts received no treatment, and the remainder received various treatments. One infarct related to the grade 2 blunt carotid injury was identified. Despite a 14% rate of radiographic worsening in the grade 1 and 2s cohort, there were no adverse clinical outcomes associated with these radiographic changes. They conclude that the use of aspirin or other antiplatelet or anticoagulant meds in these low-grade injuries do not appear to correlate with radiographic injury, and their use may not eliminate the very small risk of cerebral infarction. As a companion paper, there's another one by Scott, first author, called The Clinical and Radiologic Outcomes Following Traumatic Grade 3 and 4 Vertebral Artery Injuries. Again, vertebral versus the other paper, which was blunt carotid. A 10-year retrospective analysis from a Level 1 trauma center. This is Journal of Neurosurgery 2015. This is a retrospective review of 79 grade 3 or 4 blunt vertebral cerebrovascular injuries. Remember, grade 3 injuries are defined as stenosis of the vessel greater than 50% or the development of a pseudoaneurysm, and grade 4 injuries were defined as complete vessel occlusion. Repeat imaging of grade 3 blunt vertebral injuries showed that about 40% of the injuries were radiographically stable, 43% resolved, and 13% improved, and one worsened. All grade 3 injuries that were treated were managed with aspirin or clopidogrel alone, as were the majority of grade 4 injuries. There were 3 cerebral infarctions thought related to the grade 4 injuries, which were likely present on admission, and all 3 of these patients died. No cerebral infarctions directly related to the grade 3 vertebral injuries were identified. They conclude that the majority of the high-grade blunt vertebral artery injuries remain stable or are improved at final follow-up. Let's go on to paper 7, which has a first author of Peterson, and it's an editorial entitled Mild Narrowing of the Cervical Carotid is Noted. This is from the Journal of Neurosurgery 2015. So some takeaway points from this editorial talking about narrowing of the carotid. The BIFFL classification, that's B-I-F-F-L, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, B-I-F-F-L, probably not best internet friend for life, but the BIFFL classification, which is called Blunt Carotid Arterial Injuries, Implications of a New Grading Scale. That's from Journal of Trauma in 1999. So this scale divides the injuries into 4 categories. Less than 25% narrowing of the cervical carotid, 25 to 50% narrowing, a pseudoaneurysm or occlusion. Previous studies have shown high rates of stroke for carotid occlusions, but low rates for vertebral occlusions. Most other large studies on lower grade lesions show stroke rates higher than the Parkland series, which was 1%. Other studies show stroke rates on the order of 6 to 10% for grade 1 to 2 injuries. Many strokes occur prior to the time when treatment is possible, up to 90% in some series, so they arrive to the ED with the infarct already occurred. Given the difficulties of instituting anticoagulant therapy in polytrauma patients to begin with, this author bears questioning on how effective any treatment is going to be trying to stop strokes in this population. Given the safety profile and similar efficacy to anticoagulation with heparin, aspirin has emerged as the preferred treatment choice for low-grade blunt carotid injuries. These lesions are dynamic, and they have a significant risk of worsening over time. Again, the BIFFL series found that 45% of the grade 2 lesions progressed to pseudoaneurysms. That's a different paper titled Treatment-Related Outcomes from Blunt Cerebrovascular Injuries, Importance of Routine Follow-Up Arteriography. That's from Annals of Surgery in 2002. And again, all these references will be posted on the blog. Let's go to the last paper, number 8. The first author is Steinberger. It's entitled The Top 100 Classic Papers in Lumbar Spine Surgery, and this is from Spine in 2015. This is an interesting listing of the most frequently cited papers. The most cited article was found to be the paper from 1990 by Bowden et al. That described MRI findings in individuals without back pain, sciatica, and neurogenic claudication, showing that spinal stenosis and herniated discs can be incidentally found when scanning patients. Bowden is the first author. Abnormal magnetic resonance scans of the lumbar spine in asymptomatic subjects, a prospective investigation. This is from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery American from 1990. I think this is something that we've all known. We've seen it in the myelography literature and the CT literature and then the MR literature that, you know, the noise level is very high in this population, that even in asymptomatic subjects, just the fact that, you know, your heart's beating and you're breathing, you have a fairly high percentage of patients who have disc herniations, even if asymptomatic. So when any one patient comes across and has a herniation, it's very hard to precisely define a causal relationship between that herniation and that patient's pain. The second most cited study similarly showed that asymptomatic patients who underwent lumbar MRI frequently had lumbar pathology. So again, this is the second most cited paper. This is by Jensen et al. It's called Magnetic Resonance Imaging of the Lumbar Spine in People Without Back Pain. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine from 1994. In this paper, 98 asymptomatic patients underwent MR, with 52% having a bulge at one level, 26% having a protrusion, and 1% having a disc extrusion. Somewhat comforting, maybe philosophically, that only 1% of patients who are asymptomatic have what would be characterized as a pretty big herniation or a disc extrusion. Very few have, you know, those large herniations. I'm not sure what to do with a finding like a bulge, where the majority of patients who are asymptomatic are defined as having a bulge. Does it then become a normal variant? I don't treat it that way, but it kind of makes you wonder what really is the significance of that abnormality. The third most cited paper was the 2000 publication of Fairbank reviewing the Oswestry Disability Index. And that, again, first author of Fairbank, the Oswestry Disability Index from Spine in 2000. And that's it. I hope you take a look at those papers, or at least found some of them interesting to follow up on. Thanks for sticking with me to the end of this. If you have feedback on this podcast, please email me with your constructive criticism or praise at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. That's ajnr.e as in echo, I as in India, C as in Charlie. Until next time, thanks so much for listening.